The Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast is proud to be sponsored by Dr. Spork's 3D Terrain. From retro greenskin outposts to elven fortresses and obelisks, this is hands down the best nostalgic scenery you'll find out there, and all at stupidly reasonable prices. Check it out for yourself by heading over to bedroombattlefields.com/spork, that's S-P-O-R-K, and turn your tabletop into a scene from White Dwarf circa 1994. Andy Chambers not included. Brought to you by bedroombattlefields.com, this is the Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast. With 55 years under his belt, Rob Dean has forgotten more about this hobby than most of us will ever learn. On this episode, he joins me to continue our exploration into points and army lists. Welcome back to the show, Rob. How are you doing today?
Good. It's a bright and early morning here on the east coast of the U.S. Actually, technically, it's overcast at the moment, but I am up and moving. So this has been a bit of a long weekend. I went down to visit my son and interact with my granddaughter. So unfortunately, we didn't quite have time to put a game on the table, but it had been at least proposed as an activity.
Mm.
You know about that sort of thing at the moment. I think mine's a little younger than yours right now, coming up on 3 next week. So a couple of weeks.
Yeah, just a wee bit too early for like a 15,000 point game at this stage, I guess.
Yeah, we are considering what we're going to accumulate for her other than the Homecast zoo animals for which I've been accumulating the molds for several years.
Mm-hmm.
So as soon as our weather gets better and I can take the molds outside, we have giraffes and hippopotamus, rhinoceros, lion and tiger and bear. Oh my. I've kind of lost track of the mold collection at the moment, but there's a few others. I think there's an ostrich and so forth. So, and a bunch of farm animals.
I've just got down from the attic. I don't know if they had these in the US. Monster in My Pocket. They were a thing in the sort of early 90s. They were, do you remember them at all?
Well, it had been in the parenting stage, so I don't remember buying them for my kids.
They were, so you got like, well, it was, they were essentially about 28 mil size and they were little sort of rubbery monsters. Now, it was all popular lore, you know, you got an ogre and a dragon and Medusa and they were collectibles. So they came with, you know, you got cards with them and stuff. And it was my kind of earliest experience of like collecting stuff like that, and very similar to miniatures, I guess, in a lot of ways. Like they had a game around it, and I just got them down from the attic because I've still got them, and I imagine the wee one will be very excited to see them, so I'm going to show her them tonight if she's good.
It sounds like you've been training her up right, so.
Yeah, I don't know if you heard of that Amazing Tales book that I was talking about recently, like an RPG book for very young kids. She's been really enjoying that too. I'm not experienced at all with RPG games, but this was just very simple. It just it gives them a little character sheet. So her favourite part is just drawing a character initially. And then you've got four skills, and you've just got to roll for anything you do in the story. You've just got to roll more than a 3. So you've got something you're fine at, and that's a D6. And then something you're good at, that's a D8. And then something you're pretty good at, I think it's a D10, and then your exceptional skill is a D20. So obviously it gets easier the higher you're rolling, but it's not often as well that they roll under 3. And sometimes when she does, she just says, oh, I'll try that again. So didn't knock the goblin out this time, I'll just try it again. But aye, she's had all sorts of skills and abilities. Like one of her skills is like baking cakes. So each time I'm telling the story, I keep having to come up with a scenario where she has to bake some cakes for somebody to, for it to move the story along. So it's really good. Amazing Tales, it's called.
Okay, well, I'll have to take a recommendation on that one because that is not one of the children's role-playing games that I have run across in my role-playing game stuff. So I keep an eye on the role-playing community. I've been part of that too for almost as long as I've been part of miniatures. So starting with Dungeons and Dragons in 1976. My 50th anniversary, frighteningly, is coming up this month.
50 years in the hobby.
Yes. Well, that's the role-playing games. The miniature, of course, goes back even a little further than that. So,
Yeah.
1961. So, yes, it's been 55 years. That's frightening. I don't even think I'm that old.
You'll have seen a lot of changes in that time, I'm guessing. And of course, I mean, based on, you know, our interactions over the last few years, like Games Workshop represents almost no percentage in your hobby at all, does it?
Basically, that's correct. If you want the longer version of that, I had a flirtation with Warhammer Ancient Battles back around 2000. And then sometime during the pandemic, because of the fact that Games Workshop is so much the 800-pound gorilla in the room, I decided that I had an itch to find out what the root was. And I tracked down a copy of Warhammer Fantasy First Edition. And setting up a demonstration game of that remains on my to-do list. So at the moment, still, though, I have to live vicariously through Padre's recreation of his 1984 Warhammer game, and you can link that in if people haven't seen it yet. It's an amazing piece of work, I guess I'll put it that way. So
I was just going to say, as someone who's no doubt ran a lot of campaigns over the years, how does what Padre's doing, and we'll take away the video production and all the story stuff that he's putting out there, with how he runs these campaigns, did you draw any parallels with anything that you've put together in the past, campaign-wise?
You know, we haven't done as much campaigning as you might think. So over the course of the years, I mean, in recent years, we had, as a spinoff of our club, a skirmish game campaign session where we did 2 years of Frostgrave campaigns, 2 years of Ghost Archipelago, and a year of Stargrave. So we had the skirmish campaigns. I have a somewhat stalled solo campaign, which is probably a little more like what he's doing, but on a much less records intensive scale. And my one shining moment was to get my Imaginary Nations 18th century stuff out for a campaign. And I hesitate to say that that's been over 20 years ago now. That was based on Charge, which has a very rudimentary point system in the first place. So it wasn't set up that way. But since Padre's interview with you, I have sat down and found a copy of Mighty Empires. That's the one I'm looking for online, and read that. I would like to do something like that, but I know from past experience that it's likely to founder on the amount of logistical paperwork that needs to be done. I'm really amazed and impressed, apart from the video presentation, that he's managed to hold that together for as long as he has.
Mm-hmm.
I just imagine reams of three-ring binders, or, you know, megabytes of, well, maybe terabytes of computer files at this point.
What you been playing at the club recently?
The club is all over the place as usual. Last week, we did a 172nd scale World War II game that is technically, by the way, part of a campaign, but it's organized more like a Frostgrave campaign in that there's no map moves. We're just tracking the activities of our squads and did we require enough replacements that the overall morale level goes down and so forth. Using a club-developed set of rules called Combat Patrol, which is World War II on cards. Everybody has a deck of very busy cards that have all the information on whether you hit somebody with your weapon, where you hit the target. I don't know. There's about 10 pieces of information on those cards. I'm admitting in my aging brain that it would be not unpleasant from my point of view to play with something a little bit simpler. But we have a club. The club's convention is coming up in about 3 weeks, the 20th, 21st of March. And I am taking it easy this time and not actually running anything at it. Let me think for a second. What all have I been playing? I should have pulled my logbook out with me. Okay, so far this year, we have had out the 172nd scale World War II game. We did a retro game with some 15 millimeter Civil War and the Johnny Reb rules in their second edition from the 1980s. boy, I have some thoughts about the 1980s at this point. We did a To the Strongest game of Ancients. I was in an invitational game with some 1/600 scale Napoleonic ships, played a 25 millimeter Fantastic Battles solo game, had out my Imaginations guys, some 15 millimeter Napoleonics with home rules, and a Dragon Rampant game. So yeah, you can see we're kind of all over the map. Anybody who asks, what do you usually play? Well, the answer is I don't usually play anything, it seems. So next game scheduled is Fantastic Battles.
And of course, we were chatting away on Discord after Jason's recent episode with Jerry of On Tabletop. So you had some thoughts on the points discussion as well that I wanted to pick your brains about. So I guess you qualified this before we started recording by saying that you're not exactly a vehement defender of points, are you? But you did have some kind of opinions on the chat that was.
Yeah, well, okay, so let's start with the top, which is, I'm an engineer, so I'm a math guy by training. And if you wanted a long lecture from my brother about, who's a chemistry professor, about significant figures, I would tell you that one of the things that you have to worry about in any of these things is how accurately can you actually measure something? So I kind of automatically assume that any point system that has more than about two digits to the points probably cannot have been thoroughly calculated, right? So if somebody tells me that their unit is worth 287 points, in my mind, I already know that that system is probably nonsense, because you probably cannot determine the differences between units to that fine a scale. So does it give some idea of what things are worth? Yes. So have you played Dragon Rampant yet?
No, I've never played that one.
Okay, so Dragon Rampant is sort of a common baseline game these days, and it is based around a point system. So if you don't mind, we'll use it as an example. In the original version, the Osprey Blue Book, everybody gets 24 points as the default to build their warband. A typical unit starts off at 4 points and then has maybe some special abilities added to it that cost anywhere from 1 to 3 or 4 points as well. And there's a lot of swing in the system with the dice that you're rolling. You're rolling dice for attack, you're rolling dice for defense, you're rolling dice for morale checks as you go along. If you actually look at it and ask yourself, is, let's say, flying, an ability that's worth 2 points, worth having another scout unit on the table, which also costs 2 points by itself? Well, it's really, it depends on so many other things. It depends on, you know, whether you can get that unit into action. It depends on whether the scenario requires you to get something on the table fast. So the point system is not really telling you that much about whether the overall game is going to have a 50% chance of winning. So if that's what the points are about, then every point system starts off on a bad footing. If it gives you some rough idea of whether things are approximately, it starts off at some idea of what the author thought, with hopefully some testing, the relative values of things were. But, you know, with Dragon Rampant, you've got 5 or 6 basic unit types, and each of them performs differently in terms of whether it's easy to activate, whether you can make it perform a charge, whether you can activate its shooting, and so forth. So there's no real expectation that if you laid exactly the same situation on the table, it would come out the same way. And a lot of what you're experiencing is going to be based on, you know, the exact peculiarities of the terrain and so forth. Does a group with twice as many points have a much better chance of winning than the group with half as many points? Yes, probably. So as a rough guideline, it's a help. But, you know, as I say, then you layer a scenario over the top of that. Dragon Rampant comes with a set of 6 scenarios. And one of the scenarios that I have only played a couple of times involves collecting a bunch of magic crystals that have been scattered over the tabletop. And that gives you a lot of the victory points through picking them up quickly, which means that if your warband has something fast and easy to activate for movement, you can get out there and collect all the points. Does that mean that your light cavalry is really worth twice as much as your heavy cavalry because it's faster? Yes, in this circumstance. But in the absence of knowing something about the scenario, the points are not really meaningful.
The Minigamer is a free weekly email newsletter where I curate 5 cool things that caught my eye in the hobby this past week. Subscribe today and have the next edition sent straight to your inbox by going to bedroombattlefields.com/email. That's bedroombattlefields.com/email. And now, back to the show. I guess this is maybe too simplistic a question, but do you think points solve more problems than they cause, or vice versa? Or does it just depend, like you're saying, on maybe if there's a scenario or whatever?
I don't know. I think it's about 6 of one, half a dozen of the other. They cause problems in that they give an expectation that they can't fulfill for evening things out. They solve problems in some respect because they usually prevent somebody from taking a completely, what would turn out to be a completely broken army. Although you go back to Dragon Rampant, and my brother will argue with you after quite a few games that the archer's archery ability is significantly under-costed because it's always very difficult to win against the guy that has the archers, unless you've got some scenario in which the killing the enemy is not the goal of the game. So I chalk that up to a bit of, well, is Dan Mercy actually English as opposed to some other version of British? I think of it as the legend of the English longbow, you know. So English rules have a strong tendency to give the bowmen a lot of power between Henry V and Robin Hood.
What about, like we've talked a wee bit about Padre, and, you know, he talked about points in relation to his campaign systems. Do you find, based on the campaigns that you've ran or played in over the years, were points important, and did they become more or less important the further you got into a campaign?
So the one time that I did the charge campaign, there were no points involved in that. That one was set up with one side having the burden of the attack, and I gave them, I think, 25% larger force. And they were encouraged, let's say, to keep up the pressure because the replacements were being provided to both sides at the same rate. So if they didn't win early on by pushing, the forces would eventually even out and they would have been unable to continue. But you get something like Frostgrave. Points in that one are set up as money. You are collecting treasure through the game, and that treasure allows you to hire better supporters. And the total amount of treasure you get is increasing the skill level of your primary characters. But we found after 5 years of playing the various versions of that a considerable difference in skill level of the leaders and figures could still be overcome by the D20 versus D20 combat comparison system. So there was always the chance that some worthless extra could kill your powered armor flamethrower guy in Stargrave. As I was able to pull off one time where my some little guy with a knife killed off the other guy's flamethrower in a single hand-to-hand encounter. So you started with things, but that one's also balanced by limiting the number of figures that you have on the table. So I don't know that it was intended for that point system to stay set up that way. With the Mighty Empires, the recruitment points in Warhammer, I mean, bear some, well, I don't want to say realistic, but let's call it appropriately flavored difficulty of recruiting things. So you're collecting up a limited number of resources, and then you're deciding what to put those into. I mean, that seems as reasonable a way of starting as anything else. Do you have a copy of Tony Beth's Setting Up a War Games campaign by any chance?
No, I don't have that one, no.
Oh, this is currently available from John Curry's History of Wargaming project as part of a larger book called Tony Beth's Ancient Wargame, I believe. I have a separate copy as published by WRG. Mine's the third edition from sometime back in the 80s. But Beth was in many respects, the father of the campaign as we know it today, and had a whole elaborate system worked out with the economics of from tax collection up to the raw materials being pulled together to take to your forges to create the weapons with which you would arm your troops. So it was a massive logistical undertaking. He didn't track points per se, but you know, he tracked soldiers' pay rates and amounts of food moving around and so forth. Abstracting that as points doesn't necessarily seem like a bad idea.
What about in relation to historical games? Do you think points have a place there, especially if we're playing something historical that was highly imbalanced?
No. If you're going to go with an actual historical scenario, the way that it seems to me that the best way to create a balanced game, and it may not be satisfying for reasons I'll come back to, is to deal with it through the victory conditions. So if you have a small force and you're attempting to delay a large force, you know you're not going to defeat them and send them scurrying off the table. It may not be personally satisfying to know that you held out for 9 turns instead of 7 before you had to retreat, but in terms of assessing victory and calling it a balanced game, that works. I remember when I was just a teenager and didn't have enough miniatures and was playing the old style hex and shit board games. I found a person who had a copy of an Arab-Israeli war game, and we played out the 6-day war. I took the Israelis and was somewhat displeased to discover that having taken 7 days to win the 6-day war, I had been decisively defeated. So, balance, yes, but you have to be in the proper gamesmanship mode in order for that to feel like a victory.
I think as well, like I'm the same as you. I'm not a proponent of points by any stretch of the imagination. But I think one criticism is that broadly they're not fun. And again, I'm not a massively experienced gamer, but myself and Callum have been playing Hobgoblin recently, and I've just put together a list to play them. You know, we're playing about 4,000 points on Hobgoblin, and I found that quite fun. You know, agreeing on the points and then just going through, seeing what's available, seeing what you could add or take away from various units. So I don't necessarily see points as like a joyless thing. Like I did quite enjoy that little game away from the tabletop. I'm not sure how that kind of relates to your own experience or thoughts on it.
Well, okay. Now that's an interesting point. By the way, I listened to the Hobgoblin podcast while I was driving home from my visit this weekend. So I had to pay a little bit of attention to the road and didn't follow necessarily all the ins and outs about how much things cost in it. I've got my own copy of the rules and it's on my to play list for this year, but I haven't gotten there yet. If you were to ask around in the historical hobby, it seems like the points, extensive use of points seems to go back to War Games Research Group, WRG, and their Ancients rules starting in the 70s. And it looks like their purpose was to support tournaments. So they had open tournaments where you bring your favorite ancient army and match it up against the other guy's favorite ancient army. And in order to provide some sort of balance, they came up with the point system. The upshot of that is that you have a separate subgame where, you know, your job is to optimize your army and get the hardest hitting or most flexible or whatever you think is going to win the game force out of a limited number of points. And that sort of activity has the advantage, if you like that sort of thing, of being something that you can do by yourself in your downtime, so you're participating in your hobby when you don't have an opponent to play with, and has a, it's the building sort of pleasure that you get from putting a Lego set together. Or my kids have spent over the years quite a bit of time playing Magic the Gathering, among their other things. And it's the kind of itch that you scratch by the deck building aspect of that. So it's not necessarily not fun by itself. I just don't necessarily, it doesn't relate a whole lot to wargaming as an exercise in getting some insight into, you know, problems of generalship, right? You can have, I guess, and this falls into the narrative gaming category. If your idea of fun is to be handed a situation, as in fact most people in the real world are, without a whole lot of control over it, and make the best you can out of it, then, you know, you don't really need points for that. On the other hand, you know, the whole, you know, can I build a better thing than my opponents? We could come up with a lot of examples from other hobbies that deal with that sort of thing too, I expect. So yeah, points give you some solo element of control over the systems that allow you to fiddle with things without having opponents.
I've been playing a bit of Blood Bowl with the wife. She's entertaining me on that front. So we've got I've got three teams at the moment. And the Blood Bowl, it's points, but it's like the analog is value, like the, you know, the amount of gold that a player costs. And I guess that if you were playing in a tournament or playing officially, you would presumably there'd be an effort to make the teams as even as possible. But I've just taken the stats straight out the book, and some of the teams are obviously much better than others, and some have exceptional star players. And I guess, you know, that there would probably be a way to balance that, but I've just left that alone and enable us to put out the strongest team possible with the players available. And it just means that, like, the human team is exceptional and at this stage haven't been beaten. So, you know, I could have tried to even that up, but I just quite like that, you know, somebody's taking charge of the team that we think at this stage can't be beaten, and it's trying to get a win against them that's interesting to me, rather than just we're having a game of chess and, you know, everything's balanced and it's just maybe the best player will win or whatever. So just some kind of thoughts on that, yeah, with Blood Bowl.
Well, I mean, I haven't played Blood Bowl, but obviously in the real world of sports, some teams are going to be much better than others, and you know, we deal with that in various ways. We cheer extra hard for our team when they win. The sports betting people will give you odds to balance things out. By the way, circle back, repeatability. That's one of the other things we need to throw into this discussion.
Yeah, what do you mean by that then?
So let's suppose we were going to set up a narrative game and we wanted ultimately for each side to have let's go with a fair chance, you know, 40 to 60% chance that if I played this again, we would sit down, either side might win the day, right? You're not actually going to get that balancing it by hand, or you won't know that you've gotten it unless you played this situation multiple times. And given the amount of dice and randomness we have in something, you probably won't know that it's actually balanced unless you've played it, you know, 10 plus times. And even I don't have any favorite scenarios in my pocket that I've used probably more than half a dozen or so times. So are they balanced? We have this issue with the club for games that we're testing for conventions, which turns out to be, you know, a fair amount of our club activity, since we're often hosting participation games at our local cons. Somebody will bring a game to a club night, it'll be a massacre of one side over the other. They'll go home, they'll think about it, they'll add more to the losing side or take something away from the winning side or adjust the victory conditions slightly, and we'll throw it on the table again. But it's rare to have an opportunity to play something more than two or three times before it's time for the convention and we throw it on the table. And therefore, we always scratch our head and wonder whether we are adjusting it for something that is actually a structural imbalance in the scenario, or whether we are adjusting it on account of one side having had, you know, an unlucky situation, or perhaps made a bad decision early in the process. So you can take a familiar scenario and hand it to some players at a convention, and as soon as one of them decides that he's going to put his artillery in the front of the column, and it slows down the deployment of everything behind it, and therefore they are unable to achieve their victory within the time limit, you know, they made a bad decision in the early stages of the game that affected it regardless of what the rest of the board position looked like. So balanced, you know, it there's a lot of variable factors in this, but it only becomes apparent after a bunch of play of a specific scenario. And in some cases in our war games, given the abilities that terrain and so forth will get you, they would have to be scenarios to be really balanced. You'd have to make sure that you measured out the distances between the woods exactly and so forth, so that, you know, one turn it didn't take three turns to get to the woods, the other game it took four turns to get to the woods. And most of the time we don't play with that level of finicky accuracy and things.
Yeah, I mean, once you've spent all that time trying to optimize the fun's probably left when you get around to playing it.
Yeah, that would be an awful lot of thinking beforehand. So, you know, as I listen to people like the Rick Priestley interview and talking about the early Warhammer period, when they just threw things on the table and tried to figure out what was sensible for them, to be trying to accomplish without worrying too much about how tightly balanced it was. I mean, there's definitely something to be said for that. But I've had games with points that ever since I've been buying rules for the most part. But did they ever really balance the game? Still hard to say. So
I guess as well, like, I've heard the argument that constraints can lead to creativity. Like, if you have limits on what you could do or what you could take, then that is actually quite a creative exercise. Or this word fun might come into it too, potentially. What do you think?
Well, that's sort of that what I'll call that deck building itch, right? So that seems perfectly reasonable. Do you engage in any artistic pursuits?
Apart from painting my miniatures, writing, I guess, writing as well.
Yeah, well, I had a dabble in photography a couple of years back, and I looked at an ad for Canon cameras, I think it was, that said something about, you know, no limits, unleash your creativity. And in practice, almost all my best photographs were taken with, you know, significant limitations in mind. And if nothing else, you're limiting yourself by what you can put in the frame, right? So if you're a painter, many painters have worked with all sorts of limitations. In painting your miniatures, have you used a Zorn palette yet?
No, I've never even heard of that.
Okay, so you can look this one up on the net. It's a really fun little exercise, but basically this Swedish painter Zorn, Zorn, from around the turn of the 20th century, was famous for using a very limited palette of oil paints. He would start with four colors, which basically boiled down to an ochre yellow, a bright red, a pure titanium white, and a black, which in the oil paint department I have to conclude was probably actually something they call Payne's gray, which is sort of a super dark blue. Right. So you mix those, by mixing those in various proportions, you can get a wide range of skin tones, yellows, browns, reds, in every flavor. What you don't get is anything green except the olive that you get by mixing the ochre and the black. And you don't get any blues except for what you get by fading out the Payne's gray with the white. So can you get a purple? Yes, you can kind of get a pale lavender by thinning out your black with your white and then mixing in a bit of the red. But for the most part, the interesting thing is somewhere along the way, I looked up one time Dark Age dyes because I wanted to paint all of my Saxons and Vikings in somewhat realistic colors, right? And the range of things that were available from actual vegetable dyes actually pretty closely corresponds to what you can get from this from mixing these colors in this Zorn system. So I'll have to post something post a picture to the Discord at some point. But I've done up a couple of units that I did using nothing but those four colors as available in model paints, you know. Which, and by the way, the other fun thing about that is, since you've only got four bottles of paint, it's pretty easy to pack a portable paint kit if you're off on a trip somewhere. So you just have to, you know, be patient about getting your tones in. But anyway, so he did a whole body of art, mostly portraiture, using these very limited palettes. So yeah, the idea that working within limitations is fun seems perfectly reasonable to me. So sorry about the long digression there.
No, I've learned some. I'd never heard of that palette before. And it's really interesting. You know, I like these examples of how people maybe feel more liberated with less options available to them, because it's fun to work out what you're going to do, I guess, how you're going to solve the problems.
Yes. So, the other thing about Zorn, by the way, if I am remembering this correctly, because I'm not the Games Workshop guy, I have seen discussions indicating that John Blanche's paintings that for the Warhammer things, all in their yellows and reds and blacks and so forth, are basically a Zorn palette setup. So yeah, I would definitely recommend that as a bit of painting fun and to enhance your paint blending skills.
As we kind of approach the end of our time, I just wanted to ask you, Rob, like if you wrote, and you know, for all I know, you maybe have wrote games in the past, if you'd put together your own rule system, would you include points or not?
If I did, I would try to keep them relatively simple. Certainly something no more complicated than Dragon Rampant or Hordes of the Things. Because as I say, I don't really think that you can differentiate things to that final level. So something where your points are described in single digits would probably be enough. But in the home rules that I've done, I haven't used points because they have to match my collection, and I'm, you know, working within those limitations when I'm designing scenarios for them.
Do you have 10 seconds, literally 10 seconds, to tell me how and where you typically listen to the Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast? If so, find our micro survey over at bedroombattlefields.com/fast, tick a couple of boxes, and you'll have helped your old pal out here immensely. That's bedroombattlefields.com/fast, FAST, and now back to the show. Have you played Open Combat before?
No, I have not heard of Open Combat.
Yeah, it's a very small scale skirmish game, miniature agnostic skirmish game. And I kind of like the way they handle points. Or it's Carol Brown, a former guest of the show. It's him that put the game together. But it's basically, you know, say you've got a warband of between four and six fighters. And it is literally, the points are, it's like 1 point for everything. So if you have a, like, there's a movement stat, attack, defense, fortitude, etc., etc. So if you're movement four, that's 4 points. If you're attack five, that's another 5 points. So 9 points total. And you go through, you know, as you build your warband that way, then there's a small selection of weapons and skills. Again, they're all 1 point each. So you may end up, you know, you start up a warrior, maybe they're going to end up about 30 33 points if they're really good. Some of your lower level guys will maybe be like 18, 19 points each. And I just thought that was quite an elegant way to handle it. Like if I want to bump them up to movement five, you know, that's 5 points. That's up to 5 points, an extra point there. So I kind of liked the way that he put that system together.
I wonder what it would look like after you'd played it for a while.
Do you think cracks might show?
I would expect so. I mean, to some extent, the whole business of setting somebody off to design something with points, that's really a system for looking for cracks in the system, right? Because you're looking for some to get as much advantage as you can out of what you've got. So, and that's no knock on him, because as I say, I think the whole business of points is inherently fuzzy to start with.
And again, I guess it depends on the player's motivation. Like I think, you know, you and I and most people listening to this are want to have a fun game and see a story unfold. I don't think many people listen to this show that are looking to gain some sort of advantage, find some sort of hidden secret and unlock it and smash their opponents at all costs. Listener does exist, please get in touch. I'd love to have you on the show. And no slight on your own preference, obviously.
They need to offer more prize money for tournaments. That would bring it out. So
yeah.
But yeah, as long as your incentives are to have fun, then that sort of activity is a take it or leave it kind of thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So.
Yeah, and again, it ties into what you were saying about scenarios. Like if I have a scenario, you know, if we play a scenario in open combat where the aim is to kill as many of the opponent's warriors as possible, you're going to try and optimize your attack and defense skills. Whereas if it's a treasure hunt, maybe movement's going to be the most value, and so on and so forth.
Yes, I would certainly agree with that. So you mentioned recently that you've been playing Song of Blades and Heroes.
Yeah.
Somewhere, I've done a fair amount of that over the years, and somewhere along the way, early on, I stumbled into what feels like I'm not going to say unbeatable, but a highly unbalanced little warband. And while I have played them in different situations, it's one of the Song of Blades and Heroes pre-generated bands that I carry in my travel box of miniatures in case I need to entice somebody into playing a game, right? I will send you that and you can fiddle with it, but I've got, you know, an equal number of points of orcs, and I think the orcs have won against the humans maybe one time out of six. So, and that's a system where I think you get 300 points or 500 points is what they recommend.
Yeah.
Indicating to my engineer brain, since there are, you know, things down to the single digits, that they think that they have three significant figures of accuracy they're alleging three significant figures of accuracy in their points. The existence of the not quite undefeated humans would suggest that there's probably a few cracks in that system. So I'll send you that to play around with if that would amuse you.
Yeah, I'll look for some Song of Blades and Heroes tournaments, and then I'll take that along and smash everyone.
Yeah, I don't think there is such a thing. So
£10,000 prize money.
Well, that would find all the cracks relatively quickly, I'm
yeah.
sure.
So. It's been a great chat, Rob. I'm going to have to go soon and pick the wee one up from the nursery. But any sort of closing thoughts?
Well, as I say, overall, I think they do have a place, but the points are only as good as the original author was able to accurately guess how things would work over a wide range of potential situations. So I don't know that small variations in points make that much of a difference in most point systems, but a difference of, you know, 2 to 1 is probably significant in most cases. So it has a place.
Thanks very much for listening to this episode of the Tabletop Miniature Hobby Podcast. If you enjoy the show, then please do share it with someone else you think might enjoy it too. And be sure to check out our Discord community of like-minded hobbyists, which you could find at bedroombattlefields.com/Discord. It'd be great to see you in there.